what I've tried to do with success, and I heard this at a funeral one time, and it was one of the most impactful things that I ever heard, is the guy said, how are you living your dash? And he said, everybody's born. When you go to the funeral sheets, you know, he got born in 1969, dash, you know, died in whatever. And,
right.
And the guy really challenged, how are you living your dash? So for me personally, I want to ask myself, how am I living my dash? How am I going to live those years in between? What impact is that going to have on the people who come in contact with me? And am I going to leave the world a better place? So that's really quite simply living my life to be the man God's created me to be. And there's an old movie, I can't remember the name of it, it's a Jimmy Stewart movie, and he says, my mom told me there's two choices you have in life. One, you can be smart, or one, you can be pleasant. And I found that being pleasant is a whole lot easier. You know, don't be a know-it-all. I think early in my career, I had all the answers. You know, it's okay. It's okay to not have all the answers. It's okay to just be pleasant. It's a whole lot easier.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina. Welcome back or welcome to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. This is your home for certified audio gold and your podcast destination where you come to get better as a coach, period. This is the weekly stop on your journey towards development, towards challenging yourself as a coach, towards improvement to move your career, your players, and your programs forward. Thank you guys for joining in on the conversation. Connect with us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at ABCA1945. And always feel free to reach out to me directly on Twitter at CoachSheets3 or by email Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. We work each day to positively change the culture of coaching, growing baseball, and serving our member coaches around the world. So let us know how we can help you guys out. Send us a message, an email, a tweet with your thoughts, or maybe just what line from the show really hit you on the other end of the call. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to subscribe, review, and share. Hit the subscribe button on your phone, your computer, your tablet. That way, every Tuesday, this show shows up for you to listen to on your time. Leave us a review on there. We want more folks to be able to find our show. Shoot that 5-star rating at us and share. Invest in those around you and help influence them to kickstart their development journey, whether it's other coaches or even your players, which, by the way, are our future coaches. Spread the great word, and we appreciate your help on those fronts. Now back into the high school ranks for this week's show, and man, did we find a winner. Chuck Box, the first-year head coach at Hartfield Academy in Jackson, Mississippi, he joins our show, and here's the stat line on Chuck, so we're all up to speed. 30-year continuous ABCA member, 28 ABCA conventions, experience on the 4-year level as a head coach, 2-year junior college level as a head coach, and now a high school head coach for the past 11 seasons, an NAIA conference championship, a Mississippi JUCO state championship, and 6 high school state championships. That's all just for starters. One of our most loyal members in this fraternity, and we're proud to connect with him over the airwaves. We're inside this show. This episode is going to be packed with tremendous perspective. Your airwaves will be littered with dimes from Coach Box as the Hawks are preparing for the state championship games this week in Chuck's first year at the helm. You'll hear his thirst for knowledge and continuous learning, how he seeks out opportunities to observe and connect with successful college coaches and taking their ideas back to his high school programs. You're going to hear his heart to serve his players and prepare them for the game of life. And you're also going to hear how Chuck takes his role as coach and his chance to impact lives very seriously. This is a fantastic episode. A lot of energy on the line on this one, and one we know our loyal listeners are going to love. So let's jump right in, pull up a bucket with us, and let's chat with Hartfield Academy head coach Chuck Box as he joins this week's show. Get ready, coaches. This great show is coming at you right now. Coaches, thanks for dialing into this week's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. We've got a great episode on deck for you today, a fantastic guest, a guy that is a loyal member inside the ABCA, 30-year continuous member, and a guy that brings a wealth of perspective across many levels. We're excited to welcome in the head coach at Hartfield Academy in Jackson, Mississippi, Chuck Box. Chuck, thanks for jumping on the call with us.
Steve, thanks, man. Hey, first of all, thank you for what you do. You spend a lot of time thanking everybody else, but on behalf of all the coaches, I think I can speak for them. The ABCA has been an awesome organization. As you mentioned, I've been a part of it for 30 years. But, man, when you came on board, you brought a new energy and a new life. And the other thing that you've done that I thought was really neat is you love to use the term pull back the curtain.
Yeah.
And what you've done is you've pulled back the curtain on so many awesome coaches and vendors. And just thank you, man. You've given us some awesome information that is very applicable to our programs. And so thank you for what you've done.
Man, you got me fired up. We haven't even started the episode yet, Chuck. I appreciate that, man.
Yeah, man, absolutely.
We've got a fantastic team here at ABCA, and with Craig, executive director, we are really going the right direction, and we're excited again to have guys like you that are inside what we do, and you're all for what we're about and where we're going, and that's where it leads into this conversation. So again, as we go through this podcast, we want to highlight successful coaches that are out there in our association. And Chuck, 30 years, man, I want you to really expand upon that. We were just reflecting before we started recording your first convention in 1992, you think. And I just want to let you know, dude, I was 11 years old when you were running into convention. But just expand upon that, your experience over the years, why it's so important to be part of our baseball coaches fraternity.
Well, the networking and the people that you meet, and then the materials that you provide are awesome. But my first convention was in 92. Tom Gladney, I was a graduate assistant coach at Mississippi College. And, you know, before that, I was telling you, Sheets, we used to buy the cassette tape. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't get the DVDs and the online stuff. You actually bought a cassette tape. And I never forget, my most popular, the one I loved the most, was a guy named Dean Stotts. He was an assistant coach at Stanford.
Sure.
And he did a talk on base running. And the base running Bible, and I remember that like it was yesterday. But 92, Tom Gladney takes me to the Lowe's Anatole in Dallas, and I was a college baseball junkie, and so I got to see, you know, the Gene Stephensons and the Ron Polks and all these icons, these mm-hmm. titans of college baseball. And I remember leaving the convention feeling so overwhelmed and insignificant. You know, I said, I'm never going to make it. There's so many people here, but I've only missed two since then. And just what it's done for my career, professionally, but also personally, to mm-hmm. have friends like you and Luther Branwood and some of these guys who I can call to talk to about anything, not just baseball, is given me so many wonderful memories and just made a difference in my coaching career.
God, as you were talking about that, you know, you are a guy that I met again through Luther, our close friend, and it was just a random dinner. We're out having dinner, and there you are with a couple of your guys, and now we're all connected, and now we've all become really close friends. And that speaks to the power not only of networking, but really understanding what ABCA is all about. You may show up with a car full of guys, but that car full can multiply itself over and over again. The more that you're willing to get out, have conversations, get to talk with other guys, and certainly build a network and continue to grow and develop. It's a pretty awesome opportunity.
Absolutely. And it just keeps getting better and better. And, you know, one of the other things that I think has been wonderful about our association, it's maybe different from some other coaches, is the coaches in our college game are very approachable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go up and you stick your hand out and speak to Mike Crox in North Carolina, he's going to take some time to talk to you. And I've seen guys do that with all the guys in our association. So I think that's something that's maybe a little bit unique about baseball coaches and the ABCA, is just the approachability of the guys and the willingness to share is really remarkable.
Mm. Well, we're excited about, you talk about heading back to Dallas. We'll be there in January of 19, and certainly going into what will be your 31st year inside the ABCA. But Chuck, before we dive into this, because there's so much I want to get to inside this interview, but start here, because it's always great to give our coaches just a platform to know where you're coming from, a guy that's going to offer experience from the four-year level, the two-year level, and then obviously what you've done on the high school level. Can you expand upon that?
I grew up in Columbus, Mississippi, which is about 25 minutes from Starkville, in the shadows of Duty Noble and Mississippi State. And I grew up at a time when college baseball was really starting to grow. It was before ESPN and picked up the contracts when they used to have the Sunday night game. And Columbus was a great baseball town. Our park and recs were really good. And, you know, I'm a little slow to criticize daddy ball. I know the term that people use and understand what they mean by it. But I'm glad dad's coached. I'm glad my dad coached. I'm glad a lot of dads coached. And I'm glad that dads are still coaching today. And we had a lot of great men who helped us, you know, grow up. And Probst Park was the name of our rec park and rec. And I had a great coach named Sammy Fletcher in high school. I went to Caldwell High School, and he played in the Red Sox organization and was just an old school baseball guy. And the other thing I was fortunate to have that really led me to coaching sheets was I had great coaches who were great teachers, and they were also great men. And I listened to the podcast with Tim Corbin, and you referenced it with the Stab Dad, and Coach Corbin talked a lot about being a teacher first. And so many of my coaches were great teachers. But as I progressed through baseball, I was a pretty average player, and I went to Freed Hardeman University and wanted to be a stockbroker, but I was really bad at math. And it kind of ran me out of that pretty quickly. And I had a chance to be a student assistant my junior year. I wasn't a very good player, and I had a shoulder injury. And it turned out to be one of the greatest things ever. And I really tell young coaches today that if you want to be a coach, start coaching. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to get a head start on my career. And I was offered, I kind of hit the college coaching thing sheets when the graduate assistantships went away. And I think that was one of the worst decisions that the NCAA ever made with baseball. And I wrote 47 school sheets my senior year to try to find a graduate assistant position. And one school reached out, Mississippi College, Tom Gladney, who's now the athletic director at Biloxi High School down on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I went there in 92 as a GA, and it was amazing. Had an opportunity to go back to Freed Hardeman as assistant in 93. And then I was there for 1 year as an assistant, was named the head coach at the age of 24.
Wow.
And I didn't know what I was doing. And I stepped into a league with Brian Shoup at Birmingham Southern and Woody Hunt at Cumberland University and Andy Rushing at Union and Lipscomb. And Coach Dugan was at Lipscomb. And I was a 24-year-old kid was really way in over my head. And I was there for 6 years, and we had some success. And I spent 4 years in junior college at Itawamba Community College in Fulton, Mississippi. I went back to Freed Hardeman for a couple of years, and I actually got out of coaching and was an assistant athletic director for a couple of years and raised the money. And missed coaching. You know, my wife says baseball coaches are like heroin addicts, not to make light of drug addiction, but, right. You know, once we get it going, we can't get rid of
it's
it.
It's a sickness.
It's a sickness, man. And so I had two young kids and really thought high school sounded great. Never had coached in high school before, but left Freed Hardeman and went to Jackson Prep, which is one of the top baseball programs in the state of Mississippi and one of the better jobs in the state of Mississippi, and was there for 10 really great years. And both my children, two of my three children, graduated from high school. And then I decided I want to give a summer baseball, travel baseball a shot, and I did that for a couple of months, and it just didn't work out real well for me. And so I spent a year as an assistant athletic director at Jackson Prep. I got out of coaching for 1 year, which was awesome in terms of being able to grow and learn and travel. And and then I took the position at Hartsfield Academy a year ago, really a year ago this month, and have been the baseball coach here for 11 years. So we're at a small school right outside of Jackson, and our community is one of the fastest growing demographics. So there's a lot of growth. We're building a $12 million high school. There's only been a high school for 5 years. So, you know, we're trying to build a program here, and it's been a lot of fun.
Wow. That's really cool. And we're going to expand upon that here in a second. I want to go into this question, 'cause I always think about, you know, certainly you can only gain perspective through experience, and to spend 30 years in the game and even the couple stops out of the game, which certainly give you a chance to find clarity, reflect, and get a better game plan walking into your next opportunity. But just detail your growth as a coach. Who is that guy that first got in at Freed Hardeman? Who's that guy that took over the junior college? Who's that guy that took over the high school route? Like, talk through how you grew as a coach and obviously where you sit today.
Well, I think at Freed Hardeman, the first time I was very fortunate, because it was a laboratory. It was a totally blank canvas.
Wow.
Nobody had really done anything there. And that, looking back on it, that lends itself to experimentation. You know, that was back when Luther and Mike Johnson were involved. And, you know, I was crazy. We would work 18, 19 hours a day. those guys were working for a meal ticket in the cafeteria in an apartment. And the fact that they still speak to me and love me to this day is remarkable. But The thing that was so awesome there, as I look back on it, Sheets, and if we could all coach like this, we would be more successful. But the results were kind of taken out. Because you didn't really worry, you know, whatever you did was better than what you had done. So
that's true.
You didn't worship the scoreboard, so to speak. So that was a time when I could really experiment and, you know, try these theories that I had and do different stuff without a ton of consequences. And it worked. We were able to get some things going. We built a pretty good program there. And then when I went to junior college, so the key was the challenge with junior college, and Mississippi junior college baseball is really good, by the
sure.
way.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and we hit the JUCO thing when there were districts. So you couldn't, it wasn't an open state. You had to recruit from within a certain counties. But the challenge with the junior college was getting guys to buy in because they were also focused on moving on. So The challenge that I had there was, it was almost like minor league baseball. You know, you wanted to do really well so you could go play at the next level. And we were able to overcome some of that and actually get guys to buy into a program and had some special years. And then high school, I really have a better understanding now of developing players because in college you go recruit guys. And it's, if you don't do a good job recruiting, you're in trouble. But, you know, it's like saying Larry Bird's not walking through the door, you know, Coach Pitino. I mean, what you get in high school is what you get.
Sure.
So I think I have a better understanding of player development and how to develop players and understand the parent side of it more. I really have a better understanding of recruiting. If I ever were to go back to college, I think I could be a much better recruiter because I've been involved in that. So all three have offered different things. I mean, through it all, I've tried to always do things the right way and, you know, run a quality program. And we've kind of run a college program everywhere we've been. And we feel like we do that really in high school, but each one of them had different challenges and different unique circumstances, but I've learned so much from each one of them.
Really good insight right there. You know, the back half of your career, spending it solely on the high school level. And I know you're humble, but I want you to go into the success you've had at Jackson Prep and the state championships that you guys won, and then taking on this new opportunity at Hartfield Academy, going to a new program. And I know it's been rough, but as we sit here on Monday night, tomorrow you guys are going to go play for the state championship. So you've really turned a culture around very quickly there at Hartfield. So let's just start there. Let's start on really building that culture at Jackson Prep and the foundation that you built there, but then bringing that to Hartfield. How's that transition gone?
Well, at Prep, I walked into a situation where there was established culture. You got it through we had actually a global leadership group there that really unique thing on campus where they taught leadership, and our football program has been legendary. We have one of the winningest high school coaches in the nation there at Prep. So a lot of that was already done through the school and through other athletic programs. We had some really great players. At one time, you know, you had, I think, six guys that were playing in the SEC from our tenure there. But, you know, culture to me is something that gets talked about a lot, and it's a word that's thrown around a lot, and I'm not sure a lot of people really even know what it is. But
to me,
culture is really, you know, Jim Schlossnagel, I've had an opportunity to be around TCU a little bit. One of the things that he says is, how you do anything is how you do everything. And to me, that's what culture really is. And we have a saying in our program where success is found in your daily agenda. So I can kind of look at what you do on a daily basis and have a pretty good idea of what you're about. But I'll tell you an example of culture. So we, 2 weeks ago, we were 5-13 at one point. We're 18-16 now. So we kind of got hot and started playing catch at the end of the year a little bit. And we've given ourselves a chance to win. But first round of playoffs, we played Washington School out of the Mississippi Delta, Greenville. And we lost game 1-3-2 in 9 innings, a really great high school baseball game. And the game ended, by the time I got back to the locker room, it was about 9:30. And I walked through the locker room on the way to the coach's offices. And we have a saying in our program that we want our locker room to be donor-ready and recruit-ready. So if I were to bring a donor through the locker room or a recruit, I want it to look immaculate. I don't care what time of the day it is. It doesn't matter. Every young man who's not a senior in our program has to take a turn at cleaning the locker room. So we assign three guys a week, and you have 2 weeks is all it really is. It's not a big deal, but they have to clean up and vacuum, and we call it sweeping the sheds, and it's just something that we do in our program from the book of the legacy that I've heard guys talk about. But anyway, I walk in, and this locker room is immaculate. We just lost a 3-2 game in extra innings, first round of the playoffs, And I walk in and the locker room is spotless. And I was like, man, this is awesome. But here's, and I put it on Twitter, but here's this part of the story that nobody knows. The young man who had to clean up that night went 0-for-5. He's a freshman and he's a little in over his head a little bit, but we're playing him. He was 0-for-5 with 4 strikeouts. But it was his turn to vacuum the locker room, and he did it. And he did it, and I told my wife, I said, we got it. That's culture. That's what culture is. And you know, once you get culture, it starts to perpetuate itself and manifest itself. Now the kids are into it. And you know, the thing that we've been able to do here at Hartsfield is we came in and we set very high expectations. And I think that's one thing. You have to talk about visualizing that success. If you don't, you're never going to do it. And and then the intent, you know, you want to throw 85. Okay, then let's talk about throwing 85. And then I think the other thing is then you got to hold kids accountable. That's the part of culture that a lot of people miss is the accountability piece. And then I think the fourth thing, Sheets, is being consistent. And when things don't go well, you can't flinch. You still, you got to make adjustments. You got to, you know, we've changed the way we practice a little bit this year. We've changed a lot of things that we do. We've gone back to, you know, we don't even watch a video anymore. We're very basic in what we do, but we haven't flinched in our consistency. So to me, that's what culture is, man. Doing those things that you got to do every day and doing them regardless of whether you win or lose, and eventually it becomes who you are and it becomes part of your daily agenda.
I want to go into this. This question just came up in my head. You've never came across to me as a guy that is, it's my way or the highway. And certainly that almost won't fly in most high school environments. So how have you been able to really adjust to dealing with 14 to 18 year old guys and getting them, even in a brand new program, getting them to understand that, hey, if we do it this way, we trust this process, this is where we're heading, it's going to be waiting for us at the other end. How have you gotten that across to those guys?
Well, I think one, you come in with a little bit of a track record and people will listen to you a little bit more. I did have that going for me, but I think just seeing us be consistent every day, and not really veering from what we do. We've lost a few guys along the way by their choice. And so sometimes it's tough love, so, you know, accountability. I think Nick Saban, you know, said it best, mediocre people don't like excellent people and excellent people don't like mediocre people. And so you set the bar and you hold guys accountable and you're going to lose some guys along the way. But I think the biggest thing, man, is, and this is so cliche, but it's just staying in the fight. I mean, that's the thing that we've talked about to our guys, stay in the fight, man. You know, so many of us give up. Or, you know, there was a point in the year where, man, I was miserable. I mean, I didn't like my team. We weren't playing well. Our culture was bad. We couldn't catch a ground ball, but we stayed with it. So I think the consistency is really, really key to your culture. And then once you get guys that are buying in, I'm not saying it gets easy, but then it just kind of becomes a part of your system. So, you know, how you keep your locker, we don't have to teach that anymore because now our 10th graders kind of know, hey, this is how we do it. And they're willing to hold our 8th graders accountable without me having to step in.
Right.
That's culture. And you start to get to that point. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It takes time. And it takes accountability. And I mean, we hold them accountable every day. I have head coaching goals every year. And that was one of mine this year, is just to hold our team accountable every day. And once you get that, man, it's fun to watch because then you can kind of get out of the way and let the guys run it.
Sure.
Which is awesome.
Gosh, you mentioned training, and that's obviously a unique dynamic. And certainly there's a lot of buzzwords around training and ideas and solutions that guys are coming up with, especially as it applies to analytics and the different technologies. We're certainly at a real delicate place in coaching where we're all considering new things because of that's the state of the game. I'm just interested from a training perspective, and I know I'm scratching the itch here with you on movement patterns and testing your guys and really understanding who they are as athletes. You want to expand upon that?
Yeah, I really do. Like you said a minute ago, I love the new age. I love a lot of stuff that's out there. But for me, the challenges that I see working with young guys, you know, take launch angle, for example. I never want to be the old guy on the lawn, the 50-year-old man that, we're going to do it. I'm a little bit of a contrarian anyway. I've always the guy asking why. I want to look for new ideas. But I think the challenge that we have is we're living in this world where, man, the information is insane. The availability out there and the opportunities to travel and see things is remarkable. But I think for me, how do I take what the game is today and the data and I apply it to where we are? A great example, that's launch angle. We know that whatever, you know, 22 degree launch angle, 98 mile an hour velocity, is the ball's going to go 410 feet. I don't know the numbers, but whatever it is. But, you know, for us, we can get a guy maybe at a 22 degree launch angle, but it's coming off at 78 miles an hour, which is, you know, a 250 foot fly ball to the center fielder.
A can of corn.
You know, and a can of corn, you know. So how do we translate that into what we're doing? And to me, and you and I talked a little bit about this, again, when I was at TCU, Zach Chant was talking about just movement patterns. You know, the thing that we have trouble with our athletes is just getting them into good athletic positions. We were, you know, we're a horrible bunting team, but we continue to work on it. And I mean, we have guys that really just can't get in a wide stance, you know, deep knee bend type of bunting stance. I mean, they can't even feel what that feels like.
Right.
Or, you know, we have guys that don't have very good barrel awareness. They don't know where their barrel is in their swing. So, you know, it's kind of like I can't give them the ribeye until we get them off the breast milk, and we're still, you know, we're still at the bottle, you know. And so,
sure,
to me, that's the challenge. And, you know, the other thing that you just saw in pro ball, you saw the highest strikeout ratio in the history of baseball for 1 month. And I understand an outs and out in the big leagues. That I totally agree with that. But, you know, average high school team was at 1.8, 1.9 errors a game. So, obviously, getting the ball in play is more important for us than in the big leagues. So, how do we take this data? How do we use it? You know, I'm watching the game the other night, and they throw Graybar Torres a 3-1 breaking ball and a 3-2 breaking ball to walk it. You know, and that doesn't translate real well to high school baseball. So, to me, that's where I'm constantly trying to watch college baseball, watch pro baseball, and then adapt the data. Not just being a guy that says, hey, that's not going to work for me, but how can I adapt that to my game?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a lot of fun, and I think it's a challenge that high school baseball coaches have especially.
And you kind of started to dive into that. One of the things I've always been impressed with you, Chuck, is you're willing to jump in the car and go somewhere and show up on campus somewhere at a high-profile college program and watch a practice and connect with coaches and really pick their brains. And all you're searching for is a new term, a new drill, a new way of thinking that you can bring back to your program. Actually, in fact, we met at one of our fall practices at Kentucky, and it was always something to me that I don't know how many high school coaches, number one, know that opportunity is out there. All it is an email or a phone call. Reach out. Hey, man, can I come on Thursday? Most coaches are going to love that because, again, if you've got great players, that just feeds right into recruiting. But number two, I think they respect the fact that a high school coach is willing to sacrifice. And that's what I've always been very impressed with. You're willing to sacrifice a couple days knowing that, man, you're going to get so much out of those couple days with someone that's been successful that you can always bring back that info and really enhance your program. Can you just kind of dive into how you've gone about doing that, maybe encourage more high school coaches to do that?
I've always enjoyed studying success, and I've really done it across all genres. Baseball coaches, basketball coaches, musicians. One of the guys that I've learned a lot from, you're going to laugh about this, is a guy named Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
Rick Rubin's the producer nobody's heard of, but he's a guy that found the Beastie Boys, man, yeah. LL Cool J, and he's produced everything from Metallica to Johnny Cash to Jay-Z, but you know, I just like to learn. I like to learn from people. And so I started this, man. I was trying to think when my first one was. I can't remember, but it was probably over 20 years ago. And, you know, John Cohen was always awesome. He always let me come hang out, and I would go watch practice. And you've been around Coach, and you know that every time I would leave Mississippi State, man, he would make me think. And I would just, okay, why do I do this? And then I just started going places. You know, I would pick the phone up. People say, how do you do it? So I pick the phone up and I call and I say, can I come visit? And they say, yeah. And then you figure out how to get there. But, you know, Sheets, I started putting it into my budget every year. And originally I would go at my own dime. And now I've worked it into my budget. I've convinced my guys that it's a lot more valuable to me to go somewhere for 2 or 3 days than really anything else I can do. I mean, I love the conventions, but man, 3 days at Oregon is, you know, that's like getting the equivalent of baseball masters, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it's amazing. But I've really been everywhere. I've been to the West Coast, Oregon, Fullerton. I've been up the East Coast, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Kentucky, Louisville, of course, all the ones around here. And then the other thing I started doing is we have like a home football game, I mean, a road football game where there's a junior college. I'll go up a little early and I'll spend the day watching the junior college practice in Mississippi, and then I'll go to the football game that night. But John Mangum, I had an opportunity to coach his son Jake, who's playing at Mississippi State. But John played football at Alabama, and you know, one of the best things I ever did, he got me in a football practice at the University of Alabama, and I got to watch Coach Saban. And so, you know, the thing about it is the coaches are so accommodating. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget, I was at Oregon, and they were so amazed that I got on a plane and flew out there. And, you know, I flew out there, rented a car, spent two or three nights, and, I mean, it was like $700. You know, it wasn't like I was spending thousands of dollars.
Sure.
I never forget, you know, they hand me a practice schedule and said, come down on the field. You know, hey, you need to get where you can see, where you can hear. Mm-hmm. Mike Fox at North Carolina spent an hour and a half with me in the video room. I mean, and they don't have to do that. But the thing that I found is they're so accommodating, like you said, impressed that this guy even reached out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really what it is, it's a total immersion. I mean, I'm talking, you know, I meet the laundry guy. I want to know how to get stains out. You know, I talked to the field guy.
Sure.
You know, how do you get rid of Polana? You know, how did you build your nail drag?
It's all encompassing.
It's all encompassing. Yeah. You know, and I've learned on these trips too, you got to eat good. And so you don't, you know, when I was at Dallas Baptist, I didn't ask Coach Huefner because he's really in shape guy. I found the trainer who had, he looked more like me. And that's where he's the guy that gives you the food.
Sure.
Still. But I had a chance to visit with your friend, Augie Garrido. I was mm-hmm. there for 3 days. He was accommodating. I mean, it's just awesome, man. And then the fun part is to take the information that you learn and then adapt it to your program. So, you know, I know that I can't spend, $40,000 on graphics in my facility, but I can figure out maybe how to do it for $500. And, you know, yep. You figure those things out. To me, that's the fun part. And the other cool thing that I've been doing here lately, I've got a couple of buddies that are tagging along with me sometimes. A couple of friends went on our last trip out to TCU. So, you know, you got the 5-hour drive where you're talking baseball, and then you mm-hmm. go to the practices, and then you come back to the hotel that night, and you kind of break down everything that you saw. You know, I'm trying to figure out where I want to go next. There's a few places I still haven't been, and I'm trying to do that. But by far the greatest thing that I've done is to go on those trips, and I wish I could do it for a living because, I mean, it's so much fun. I mean, I love it, and I learn so much. And we had a chance this year to go to spring training in New York, the Yankee spring training, and Coach McMahon, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame this year, was at Mississippi State, and we actually took our team to Tampa to play, and we got to go to a practice session before the public was there, and we got to watch them practice on the backfield, so to speak, and that was a phenomenal experience. But man, it's just really just asking, and you'd be surprised what guys will allow you to do.
You know, on so many fronts, it goes back to the way you started the entire podcast. Is, you know, we're really working hard here in the national office to positively change the culture of coaching, and we're really on the right path. A lot of feedback that comes back is, learning is cool again. That's a huge piece that comes from some of the content that we're trying to do, whether it's the podcast or the chat or the regional coaching clinics, whatever it might be. And one element, as you're talking there, Chuck, I hope that a lot of youth or high school or travel coaches or even small college coaches hear this podcast and go, you know what, I'm going to do that. Wouldn't it be great to see so much on social media or so many shares of guys going to different practices and those levels really coming together, even for just one practice day? But more than that, really the culture of sharing, the culture of networking, and the culture of brotherhood. I hope that more coaches pay attention to that, Chuck, and they take it with them and apply it to how they're going to go about learning.
Absolutely. And opportunities are everywhere. Sheets. I mean, you don't even have to pick the phone up. I was, my daughter goes to school at Lipscomb University just beforehand in Nashville. She's there. And I was up for something this fall, and I just went out and watched Vanderbilt for about 3 hours one afternoon. And most of the practices are open, and you don't even really, you don't have to necessarily call the coach. I mean, you can just show up and go to a practice, but the things you can learn. And then sometimes it's just reinforcing what you already know. And you
sure.
know what? We do that. I feel pretty good about that. That's something we did. And sometimes it's that too, but it is by far the single best, most exciting thing that I do every year. And I look forward to it every fall. Can't wait to do it again this fall.
That's awesome. Now let's dive into questions that really start to get to know
sure.
who Chuck Box is. And this is the part I really get excited about inside every interview. And you talked about studying successful people, because we all understand success leaves clues. And so I guess when you're looking at it from a global perspective, how do you define success? And I guess, would you dive into that? Has that changed over the years for you? Has it morphed? Has it really grown? But how do you define success?
I think it's changed a little bit. It's probably changed more on the personal side. And I kind of divide success up two different ways. I look at it from my personal life, and I look at it from my professional life. And sometimes in coaching, they're the same. You know, you when you're promoting your program, you're promoting yourself. Or when you're out there selling yourself, you're selling your program. And sometimes those are hard to separate. But for me personally, what I've tried to do with success, and I heard this at a funeral one time, and it was one of the most impactful things that I ever heard, is the guy said, "How are you living your dash?" And he said, "Everybody's born. When you go to the funeral sheets, you know, he got born in 1969, dash, you know, died in whatever." And,
right.
And the guy really challenged, "How are you living your dash?" So for me personally, I want to ask myself, how am I living my dash? How am I going to live those years in between? What impact is that going to have on the people who come in contact with me? And am I going to leave the world a better place? So that's really quite simply, you know, living my life to be the man God's created me to be. And that includes so many different things, from the way we treat our spouse to our families. And then from the baseball perspective, that hasn't really changed for me. That has been very simple. The vision, the mission, whatever you want to call it, was to create great experiences for our players and their families and our communities. And at the same time, I want to operate a premier baseball program that competes annually for championships. I mean, that's what I've wanted to do, and I haven't really deviated from that. And then at the same time, though, I want to use baseball, this unbelievable game that we're involved in, to foster the development of our guys athletically, academically, socially, and spiritually. And, you know, that has not really changed. And normally that really coincides with the mission of the schools where I've been. It was the mission of Freed Hardeman, it was the mission of Itawamba Community College, and it's really the mission of where I am today. But, you know, at the end of the day, coaching is creating an environment where your player has an opportunity to be successful. And that's really what it boils down to. Mm-hmm. For some of our kids, maybe it's teaching them to be successful as an attorney or a doctor or a farmer. You know, for some of our guys, maybe it's being a, you know, working for the ABCA, or being a good parent, being a good husband, being a good father. So to me, that's what it's always been about, is to create good experiences, to run a great program, to compete for championships, but then use this game to help those guys grow. And, you know, she's the cool thing about it. I'm on the back end with my guys, and I think 28 years in the game, maybe 24 as a head coach. I've seen it all. You know, I've had a couple of players pass away. Mm-hmm. I've gone through divorces. I've held a player when he just found out his wife was having an affair. You know, I've held him in a hotel and watched him cry, you know. So I got a text just a few minutes ago about one of my players coming to the game tomorrow night, former player. So you've kind of seen that, you know, and you got to understand as coaches that not everybody's going to like you. You're not going to have that relationship. That was hard for me because I wanted to have that relationship with every player.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
But it's unrealistic. It's not going to happen. But you cherish the ones that you do. I had a guy call me recently, one of my former players who has his doctorate now, and he was a physical therapist for special forces guys, and he was in Afghanistan and got dropped into some pretty serious combat situations, dropped into a helicopter. He would work on a SEAL's knee and they would pull him back out of there, and he saw some really tough stuff, kind of messed him up a little bit.
Sure.
And she told me one night, he said, "I kept hearing your voice and I kept hearing my teammates' voices." And that's success, buddy. That's
yeah.
It. You know, and I'm like, okay, this is why I do this. When, you know, when I get my brains beat out, why am I doing this? And to hear that from that young man who's now successful, married, has three kids, is, you know, that's success, is knowing that something you did along the way is help that guy grow up, and, you know, and hopefully he'll pay that forward and as a father and a community leader. But to me, that's never changed for me. I like to think maybe I've gotten a little bit better about it. I have more perspective, but mm-hmm. The roots always been the same.
Gosh. All right. So early years, talked about possibly going to be a stockbroker. I'm in your camp of being really bad at math. So anything that involved numbers and adding and division. But what motivated you to coach? What was kind of at your core that was like, yeah, I probably need to walk this path, or I just really can't get away from the game, and this is how I can get back into it. What was that?
Yeah, I wanted to be a broker because I wanted to wear Armani suits and drive a Ferrari, you know, sure, for all the wrong reasons. Yeah. But I think first of all, I think I had great high school coaches who were really good men. Mm. I think secondly, just growing up, man, around Duty Noble, my brother and I, my little brother, it was back when Mississippi State hosted like 5 regionals in a row back in the 80s. And I was just a college baseball junkie. We would buy the pass and we would go over there at 10 in the morning and we would be watching, you know, Western Carolina play Alcorn State. I mean, it didn't matter who was playing.
Sure.
We saw Robin Ventura's hitting streak, you know, college hitting streak. We saw Fullerton come in and play. We saw Wally Whitehurst pitch for UNO, you know. So I think that had a lot to do with why I went into coaching. And I've tried to get out a couple of times. And, you know, it's like the Cosa Nostra. It's like the Mafia and the Godfather. You know, they keep pulling me back in. You can't get out of it, you know. But I think for me now, Jake Mangum paid me the greatest compliment any player's ever paid me. He said, "Coach, you're the newest old school coach I've ever seen." And I was like, "Man, I could die and go to heaven right now. Put sure. that on my tombstone."
No
you know?
Doubt.
But I think what we have to do is, I think we're needed now more than ever. And you know, I was thinking about this the other day. I was talking to a friend of mine, and if you listen to the world today, you think it's the worst place in the world to live. I just don't buy that. I think the kids we're coaching to now are better. They're as good as any kid we've ever coached. I think the parents have changed, and I think the choices that our guys have to make. You know, she's a high school athlete today has to make more choices than I did in a month.
That's right.
With all the information that's coming out of. But you know, she's. I was thinking about this. Like, what would it have been to be coaching in 1865? When the Civil War was going on.
Sure.
What about 1918 during World War One? Look, I had a friend of mine the other day telling me that his dad was coaching basketball right after World War II, and he went into halftime, and all his players were smoking cigarettes in the locker room at halftime. And he said, "Who am I to tell these kids that just fought the Battle of the Rhine, the Battle of the Seine, these guys that landed on the beaches in Normandy, that they can't smoke a cigarette during
right.
halftime?"
Right. Oh, my God.
And, you know, we just forget that there's been challenges with teenagers all the way back to Socrates. I mean, this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so for me, I think that how do we, the trick to me, the guys like Mike Krzyzewski and these guys that have done it for so long, how do they continue to teach the same core values in the modern vernacular, you know, with the world that they live in? And to me, that's the fun part. And I think that's kind of what motivates me. And I think that's changing the fact that I've raised children, so I kind of see that. I kind of understand where they are. But I also think we got to have perspective, man. It's, you know, being a teenager has always been kind of hard. But we think it's so bad right now. But, man, I mean, what was it like in Vietnam when my parents were growing up? My mom, it would take 3 days before she would find out if my dad survived a mortar attack. You know, right. Now we're watching it on TV. So I'm not saying one's better or worse or good or bad. I'm just saying that I think these challenges have always been there. So what motivates me is how do we connect with guys in today's society using their platforms and the way they communicate and still teach the core values that my dad taught me and my dad's dad taught him. And to me, that's what keeps me motivated. And that's what's fun. And it's challenging. It's not easy.
Sure.
And it's not for the faint of heart, but I think it's important that we have guys that still do that now more than ever.
That's a fantastic point. Well said. Going to this, I'm interested as you've certainly changing programs, changing school colors, seeing the game differently, building a brand new program, but watching the game, or maybe it was at practice, or maybe it was in a coaching meeting where something happened where you went, man, you know what? I've been teaching it this way. Maybe I should do it this way. What's something recently that you saw that really challenged where you were at inside the game?
Well, I think, you know, one thing is just how to use energy in your swing. You know, I kind of grew up during the stupid, you know, squish the bug and all that stuff. And I think we raised a generation of, you know, guys that are real rotary. I think that's something that I've really rethought a little bit. I think the other thing, and probably the biggest thing for me right now, and this is kind of where we are in our teaching is, I think mechanics are so incredibly overrated. I think mechanics are what guys use as a crutch. When our kids aren't swinging it well, they want to know about their mechanics. And we've got so many people out now that are teaching the game, instructors, and some of them are awesome, man. And, you know, I look at our kids that go to these different things or vitamins or that makes their swing better. Great. But I think for us, and I was talking to Andy Phillips about this not too long ago, because Andy and I were about a month ago having the same conversation. Used to be at Alabama. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we focus more on is approach and timing. We've gotten away from the mechanical breakdown of swing as much more. And I heard Todd Williams on one of your podcasts. Matter of fact, I went out and bought his book. Book's amazing.
Yes, it is.
We every summer take two or three developmental topics as a staff. And one of ours in summer is really kind of redoing our offensive system. And I've got the book on my desk. And I mean, I cannot wait till season's over with it to dive into that. But I think for me, that's one thing that we've really rethought a little bit is instead of talking about swinging mechanics, concentrate more on timing and your approach, getting good pitches to hit and then being on time. You know, Coach Mozziello, who I think is the best, told me, you know, you watch amateur hitters compared to high school hitters, and most of our guys, they start too late, you know. And I heard somebody say, you know, don't worry about when you get your foot down, worry about when you get it up, you know. And so that kind of concept, I think something that's been reinforced for me from watching a lot of high school guys is high school coaches don't throw the fastball enough. We played some teams this year where, you know, they just throw too many breaking balls, you know. So that's another thing that we've thought a little bit about. And then alignments. That's something that we've, you know, high school baseball, you don't see shifts a whole lot because
sure,
you know, you don't see guys enough. But we did one of our night sheets. It's awesome. We had a big time lefty pull guy. We played the school three times during the year, so we created a shift, man. We called it Fortnite. It was awesome. We put all three of our
right up their alley.
We put three infielders on the right side of the field and had four outfielders and nobody on the left field side of the diamond. And the kid tried to bunt, and he hadn't bunted all year, and so he couldn't get the bunt down. And I think we held him to two singles in a series. So, you know, we're kind of looking at that a little bit too. You know, are we, you know, not crazy shifts, but mm-hmm. but that's one of the things that we've kind of dabbled around a little bit. But really, to me, the biggest thing is probably getting away from mechanics and leaning more towards teaching approach and timing, which I've heard you talk some about on some of your podcasts. And that Todd Williams podcast was that was amazing.
Yeah.
The stuff that came out of that, man, I almost had a wreck a couple times trying to make notes while I was driving down the road in my car, you know, listening to it.
Love it. And for coaches paying attention, that book is High Scoring Baseball, and it is one that will challenge where you're at offensively and how you're going about scoring runs. Phenomenal book. I will tell you, even as recently as this morning at breakfast, Luther and I were eating at the NAI Regional there in Williamsburg, and I was challenging him on alignment. And I was making him try to see it a little bit differently, just in terms of shifting and understanding pull hitters and percentages. And we were actually having that conversation even as early as this morning, Chuck. So it's out there. And again, it's just really just recognizing the change in the game, what the game's telling us to do, and just how to look at things a little bit differently. Get outside your comfort zone and look at it differently.
One of the things I think you got to be careful about with that, there is a danger, and I'm going to share a great story with you. You know, one of the things I tell my guys is listen to people with wrinkles.
Yeah,
you know, and here's a great example. So when I first started going to all these colleges and whatnot, the thing was dynamic stretching. You didn't get away from static stretching. It's dynamic, you know, active stretching, big deal. And so I never forget. I called my father. He's in his 70s now, but he played for Bull Sullivan, who was Sports Illustrated wrote an article about him in the 80s, the toughest coach that ever lived. My father played for him at East Mid. Well, Last Chance U. You guys are familiar.
Yeah.
So my dad played there for the legendary Bull Sullivan.
Wow.
Back in the late 50s. And they were basically running the West Coast offense in 1958. Study it. It's awesome. But, you know, I was so excited. I called my dad. Dad, I saw this man, dynamic stretch. Man, static stretching is stupid. I went on and on. My dad, he's an awesome, humble man. He said, yeah, son, that's great. Well, kind of like jumping jacks and chopping wood, right? And there was a silence on my, you know, and I'm thinking, we did active stretching. That's what a lot of that stuff was, you know, the,
sure.
the chopping wood. And so I think sometimes we have to be careful that, you know, some of the old things were good too. And they were doing some of the stuff that circled back around. So it's finding that blend, man, mm-hmm. between the two.
That's
it's, it. It's, uh, yep.
All right, expose this for me. Talk about pull back the curtain. I need to know. I know a few, but I need to know, and I think our listeners want to know, hidden talents and hobbies. Give me inside the Chuck Box file. Take me in there.
I have no talent. I'm just not talented at all. But, some of the hobbies I have, I mean, I love my family. Probably the one thing I'm the most proud of is my marriage. I've been married 28 years. My wife's awesome. We like to travel. I'm a big food guy. I love to eat. I'm a music guy. I love music. We go to a lot of live shows. The town that we live in here has a great live venue that we see a lot of shows. I love college football junkie. And then my son and I, we hike and backpack a lot. We've actually done the entire Georgia portion of the Appalachian Trail. You know, it's about 90 miles. I mean, the AT is like 2,100, but we like to do that a little bit. But, you know, mainly, man, I like hanging out with friends and good music. But I wish I could play the guitar. I mean, I would love to. My son does, but I don't, man. But I love to coach too. I mean, baseball is a hobby to me. I mean, it's a lifestyle and it's something we enjoy, and my whole family enjoys it. So yeah, but not a lot of talent, buddy.
That's all right. It definitely shows up on the coaching end. There's no doubt about that. Go into this, man, because this is a question that our listeners really love, because it is exposing successful people and finding out what's really going on inside their daily habits or routines. You know, recent books that you've read, podcasts you listen to, resources you would share. What would you offer our guys?
Well, I think one of the things that I used to beat myself up a lot as a young coach, and I finally realized that, man, we go through seasons in life. And I don't mean the actual off season, in season. We just, sometimes you're really on top. Sometimes your spiritual life's awesome. You're reading a lot. And then sometimes you're just not. So, you know, I'm like most of us, start off in the fall. I get up early. I try to have some quiet time. I know this past fall I was doing some meditation, which really was huge. I would try to read. I even started taking Duolingo. I was trying to learn Spanish, you know, and then as the year progresses, you know, I was working out pretty good and watching. And then as the year progresses, you start working harder and you get caught up in the daily routines. And then of course, during the season, you're basically just worn out. You know, we have to take care of a facility here, and it takes a lot of time, like a lot of coaches do. And, you know, I think you kind of get away from that, but I've learned that's okay, because you can circle back to that. And, you know, we can't beat ourselves up too much on that. In terms of resources, man, I've really kind of gotten into Tim Ferriss lately. Your show reminds me so much of some of the stuff that he's doing. You kind of do it in the baseball world, but Tools of Titans and Tribe of Mentors are two books that I've read. But his podcasts are really amazing, because what he does, to use your term, he pulls back the curtain on really successful people. He's really easy to get a hold of and listen to. Some books that I recommend, man, you got to read Good to Great. If you haven't read Good to Great, you got to read Good to Great. It's been out there for a while. It's an amazing book. One of my most prized possessions is Don Meyer's Bison Basketball Notebook. Coach Meyer basically put together, it's a whole year of their behind the scenes, everything from their meeting notes to scouting reports to practice schedules to, you know, the form that they gave the cafeteria when they ordered sack lunches to go on road trips. Phenomenal book. I think you can find it on his website. And then the other thing that I really cherish is my Bill Walsh book. It's called Finding the Winning Edge. And somebody told me the other day that it was selling for like $500 or $600 because there weren't many in print.
Wow.
But it's Walsh's whole system. Sheets, it has player meeting notes, Capology. It's a phenomenal book. Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, I really recommend for coaches, because we probably need to have more stoicism in our lives. And then another one I read about a year ago that I recommend for coaches is a book called The Four Agreements. I heard Tom Brady kept referencing this book, and I bought it. It was a real quick read. And then, of course, you know, your podcast, man. I mentioned Perry Hills was like, I've listened to that like 3 times, and I just got so many good things. The problem this time of year is I have trouble. I have to wait, you know, until I usually, when the season's over with, is when I'll dive into a lot of them when I'm traveling and whatnot. But man, I just, you know, there's so much information out there right now. Mm-hmm. And there's opportunities everywhere. And then I think the other thing I would encourage, especially young coaches, is to learn from all genres. You know, I wish I would have paid more attention to music appreciation when I was in college, or art appreciation, because that would have helped me become a better learner, and really just the discipline of learning. I think that's something that as a young guy, I didn't understand. And I really regret a lot of that, because I think I could probably be a better coach if I had a little better understanding of some of those things today. So, you know, just being open to learning in general.
I love it. Go into this. I love this question. Your most humbling moment in coaching. What still sticks out to you after all these years?
I've had a bunch of them, but two just jump off the page. 1995, it was my second year at Fried Hardeman. My first year, we went 25-26, most wins in school history. And, you know, the thing with what most of us know that have been in this a while, success is not always a direct upward trajectory. Sometimes it bounces all around. And our second year, Sheets, we went 15-36. We lost 16 one-run games.
Oh.
And I was miserable. I had an interview lined up at J.C. Bradford. I was going to circle back to that broker position. And luckily, I didn't. That was incredibly humbling. And I think the second one was in 1997 when we blew a 5-1 lead in a regional. The way the NAI is set up now, we would actually go on the World Series, but it was a little bit different back then. And we blew a 5-1 lead. And they hit a leadoff triple in the bottom of the ninth, and we walked the bases loaded and brought in our best strike thrower, and he promptly threw four pitches, and we got beat on a walk-off walk. We were actually ranked third in the country, and then lost the next day, and we were out of the regional. So those were, I still wake up at night, you know, thinking about that one. But those were two really humbling experiences. But the beautiful part of those is there were great successes that came after them, and I'm not sure, had I not had those failures, that I would have had my successes. So. I think that's something else that, you know, failure is just a step to success, man. If you stay in the fight long enough, you'll see that. But those were tough at the time.
Sure.
Really tough.
Oh, my gosh. Take us into the locker room. Take us on the vans, the buses. Funniest stories from over the years. What jumps off to you, Chuck?
There's a Luther could probably tell you this one. There was a player that we had, one of my best friends. His name's Brian Stewart. He's actually the head football coach at Briarcrest High School in Memphis. Probably the funniest human being I've ever been around. And he grew up in Coldwater, Mississippi, man. He had an uncle. I can talk about him now because he's no longer with us. But he had an uncle named Uncle Guyton. And he used to always talk about Uncle Guyton and how bad a dude Uncle Guyton was. And he was kind of the black sheep of the family. And he would always tell us that Uncle Guyton carried, you know, 5 guns everywhere he went. And I'll never forget one day we were coming back from Delta State. And we were going down this old back road highway, and we pull up to Guyton's General Store, and there stands Uncle Guyton. I had never believed a word Brian Stewart said in his life, but all of a sudden, Guyton steps out of the truck, Sheets, and he proceeds to display 5 different weapons to us. And while I was sitting on the bus, he pulled 2 guns out of his boot, one out of his holster, one out of his pocket of his blue jean jacket, one out of the back of his pants. And I told Stu that day, I said, Stu, I believe everything you tell me from this day forward. Luther Bramlett, I think, was on that trip. But we had some great times. And, you know, used to, we would take those dadgum vans all the way from, you know, Henderson, Tennessee to Barry, Georgia.
Yep.
Just miserable. You know, we didn't know what a charter bus was. So we, sure. We would take the vans. And that lend itself to some crazy times. But that was probably one of my favorites. You know, this guy was carrying 5 pistols in his pockets
on his person.
On his person. Yeah. It was, you know, wow. You know, that's NAI baseball, man. Sure. You know, it's at its best.
Love it. That's awesome. Defined.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah.
Go into this one. I love talking about and giving guys the opportunity to reflect on their personal Mount Rushmore. And what we're talking about is the 3 or 4 guys that have impacted you the most in this game. And when it's all said and done, you hold them in high esteem. Who would those folks be?
Well, you know, personally, my parents and my wife, I mean, I think that's obvious. And mine are a little different because, you know, one of the things that happened to me, I kind of became a head coach at such an early age. I missed a lot of the coaching tree.
Sure.
And, you know, that's something that I regret a little bit because I was out on my own so quick. But, you know, I think Coach Polk, I know Coach Polk, I didn't play for him, but Man, he was just such a pivotal part of who I was as a kid, because everybody talks about what he did for SEC baseball, but the trickle down effect in our state was phenomenal because he showed guys how to coach baseball. Coach Pat McMahon was a part of that. And Mark Johnson used to be there, but when I was a kid, Coach Johnson was a part of that whole Mississippi State staff. I think that was big. I think Coach Ferris, Boo Ferris at Del State, again, didn't have a chance to play for him, but I knew him personally, and the way he impacted baseball in our state, I think I felt the ripple effect of that. And that's, one life affects another, man. That's just an awesome story to know that I never really had direct contact with those guys, but because of the way they changed the sport that I love, it gave me some opportunities down the road. So I think those two guys were huge. My high school coach, Sammy Fletcher, was amazing. And then, of course, I mentioned Tom Gladden. He gave me my first job in 92. And, and then here recently, I had, Bill Mosiello has been, I've learned so much from him. The opportunities that he's given me to talk and listen to him has been really huge. But there's been so many guys out there that have been so willing to share. It's hard to just name one or two, but that's kind of what I would think off the top of my head. Those guys have been amazing. And it's not, I guess the message I'm saying is you don't have to necessarily play for a guy or to be under that tree to be impacted by him. But, and then Luther, that was the other one that I kind of thought about. Luther has been amazing, and I've been able to, he's taught me to off some ledges a couple of times. And the thing I love so much about him, man, is his consistency. He's just, shows up every day and does his job and loves his kids. And I've learned a lot from him too. So been very fortunate, man, been around a lot of great people.
There is no doubt about that. I want you to go into this because coaching so many great players and affording the opportunity to be around so many great baseball people and growing up in great baseball communities and all of that, describe what you think are the qualities of the best players, the best teammates, the best people that you've been around in baseball. Really identify those for our listeners. Maybe we can try to find those in ourselves in our programs.
Well, I think one of the things that I really thought about when you sent this question to me, I didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about that. Most of the stuff I've thought a lot about, but the question that you sent me, John Coyne, who you had the pleasure to, you were on his staff. You were there at Kentucky, right?
2008.
Yeah, 2008. Well, one of the things he loves to tell is when you go up there for the coaches clinic, he says our guys get X amount of dollars worth of equipment, but the first thing we give them is a bracelet that says FIO.
That's it.
And I got to thinking about the great guys I've coached, the guys with the Jake Manghams, the Parker Caraces, the guys over the years, the Jonathan Van Every, some of these guys are just super players. And one of the things that they did is they can figure stuff out. They just, and a lot of times it's not because they're the most talented or the best. They just stay in, and like I said, they stay in the fight. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that I've seen, especially in high school, is guys that take ownership in their game. And, one of the epidemics that we have right now, and Skip Bertman talked about this when I first started coaching, is the transfer of blame, and one of the things that I've kind of seen in high school in my 12 years in this landscape is our kids, a lot of them don't want to own their game. And what I mean by that is they want to put it on their parents or their high school coach or their pitching instructor or their hitting instructor or their personal trainer. And it's really ironic that in this time of this plethora of information that they can get, I mean, you can go online and really teach yourself a lot of stuff if you want to, yet they're not willing to own the game. And I think the great ones I've had, they own their game. Jim Carter is the high school baseball coach at Good Pasture High School in Nashville, Tennessee, played for me. I'll never forget in 1996, 1997, going in a bookstore in Jackson, Tennessee on a Friday night during the offseason and running into Jim and his girlfriend. He was a junior in college, sitting in the baseball section of the bookstore reading a Ted Williams hitting book.
Wow.
Trying to get better.
Sure.
And I think it's owning your game. And then I think the third thing, man, is just like I mentioned earlier, stay in the fight. Just keep competing. And just, that's the thing about, Mangum's gotten a lot. I mean, Mangum just never quits, man. He just keeps coming at you. He's relentless. And to me, I think those are probably the three things that most, and then I think maybe a fourth thing is the ability to get out of yourself and be a teammate and help your teammates get to another level. Those were some of the great ones. And some of the great guys I've had have done that too. Yeah, very selfless.
So good. Chuck, you have been absolutely awesome, point blank. But I know there's a little bit more advice in the tank. And whatever nuggets you got left in your pockets, brother, pull them out. What's the best advice that, number one, you've been given? And then also, what else would you offer any coach paying attention to this podcast? Where are you going to send them?
I think there's a couple things, man. I think, first of all, and I really want our young coaches to hear this, you need a trouble tree. And one of my favorite stories has been told to me, and I love to tell it. There was a gentleman that lived in this house, and he would watch this man come home every day. And this man didn't have a very good job. He didn't make very much money. He didn't have a very good house. But he would come in every day, and he would touch this tree outside of his house. And he would do it every night, and he would see him in the morning. And he was so happy and so pleasant and just really enjoyed his life. But the guy always thought he doesn't have a very good life, you know. And so finally, after months of watching this guy do this, he asked him, he said, "Sir, I see you every night. You come in, you touch this tree. Why are you doing that?" He said, "That's my trouble tree." He said, "What do you mean it's your trouble tree?" He said, "Well, every night when I come home, I take all my troubles and I hang them in that tree. And then I go in and I don't take them to my wife. I don't take them out to my children. And, you know, it's amazing when I wake up the next morning and I come out to get in my car to go to work, the troubles are gone." And I thought, you know what, man, that's something I needed to hear as a coach. You need a trouble tree. I think the other thing, there's an old movie, I can't remember the name of it, it's a Jimmy Stewart movie, and he says, my mom told me there's two choices you have in life. One, you can be smart, or one, you can be pleasant. And I found that being pleasant is a whole lot easier. You know, don't be a know-it-all. I think early in my career, I had all the answers. I was a know-it-all. You know, it's okay. It's okay to not have all the answers. It's okay to just be pleasant. It's a whole lot easier. And then I think the last thing, man, is just shut up. And that's something I'm working on. Don't talk so much. You know, listen to other people and you know, be curious and ask questions. But also be willing. You don't have to have all the answers, you know. And I think that's something that took me a long time to understand. I think raising daughters really helped me with that a little bit too, being able to listen a little bit more. But, you know, those are three things I think that I would love for really the younger guys to hear is, you know, have you a trouble tree, and be pleasant, don't be a know-it-all, and just be quiet, you know, and listen. And it made a difference for me. I'm still working on that last machine.
Yeah.
My mouth gets me in trouble sometimes, man.
Well, especially but when you're getting interviewed, we expect you to talk. So I'm glad that you didn't shut up on this one. Chuck, man, again, on behalf of the ABCA and our association and our membership, to have a guy that's been so loyal to what we're about and such an integral part of where we're going, thank you. And we're just thankful we're able to get you on. We're excited about what's going on tomorrow, man. Again, walking into the state championship there in the state of Mississippi, we wish the Hartfield Academy and your club the very best of luck. Thanks for being part of the ABCA, Chuck. Thanks for jumping on the call. We wish you the best of luck, my man.
Thanks, buddy. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Thanks so much for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast and checking out another one of our Dugout Chatter episodes. We love highlighting our loyal members, and we appreciate you letting us deliver some certified audio gold to each of you checking out this show. Here at the American Baseball Coaches Association, we are here to serve coaches around the world with almost 10,000 inside our coaching fraternity. So let us know how we can help. Head over to our website, abca.org, for more information. Make sure you're following us on Facebook and Twitter at ABCA1945. And feel free to reach out to me directly on Twitter at CoachSheets3 or by email Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at abca.org. We'd love to hear from our proud members and continue to find ways to keep growing the game together. And as always, coaches, thank you for listening in and staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. Until next week, we ask you keep growing, keep developing, keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.